Disc 2.
The country folk took refuge in the woods when the Burgundians came, but the citizens of Soissons could not hide when the soldiers ransacked their houses for hoarded food. Sir Enguerrand de Bournonville, the Burgundian commander, expected his French enemies to arrive in the early summer, and he was planning to endure a long siege, and so he piled grain and salted meat in the cathedral to feed the garrison and townsfolk. Nick Hook helped pile the food in the cathedral, which soon smelt of grain, though beneath that rich aroma was always the tang of cured leather, because Soissons was famous for its cobblers and saddlers and tanners. The tanning pits were south of the town, and the stench of the urine in which the hides were steeped made the air foul when the wind blew warm. Hook often wandered the cathedral, staring at the painted walls or at the rich altars decorated with silver, gold, enamel and finely embroidered silks and linens. He'd never been inside a cathedral before, and the size of it, the shadows far away and the high roof, the silence of the stones, all gave him an uneasy feeling that there must be more to life than a bow, an arrow and the muscles to use them. He did not know what that something was, but the knowledge of it had started in London when an old man, an archer, had spoken to him, and when the voice had sounded in his head. One day, feeling awkward, he knelt before a statue of the Virgin Mary, and he asked her forgiveness for what he had failed to do in London. He gazed up at her slightly sad face, and he thought her eyes, made bright with blue and white paint, were fixed on him, and in those eyes he saw reproof. "Talk to me," he prayed. And there was no voice in his head. No forgiveness for Sarah's death, he thought. He had failed God. He was cursed.
"Think she can help you?"
A sour voice interrupted his prayers. Hook turned and saw John Wilkinson. "If she can't," Hook asked, "who can?"
"Her son,"
Wilkinson suggested caustically. The old man looked furtively around him. There were a half-dozen priests saying masses at side altars, but otherwise the only other folk in the cathedral were nuns who were hurrying across the wide nave, shepherded and guarded by priests.
"Poor girls," Wilkinson said.
"Poor?"
"You think they want to be nuns? Their parents put them here to keep them from trouble. They're bastards of the rich, boy, locked away so they can't have bastards of their own. Come here, I want to show you something."
He did not wait for a response, but stumped towards the cathedral's high altar that reared golden bright beneath the astonishing arches that stood, row above row, in a semicircle at the building's eastern end. Wilkinson knelt beside the altar and dropped his head reverently.
"Take a look in the boxes, boy," he ordered Hook.
Hook climbed the altar where silver and gold boxes stood on either side of a gold crucifix. Most of the boxes had crystal faces, and through those distorting windows, Hook saw scraps of leather. "What are they?" he asked.
"Shoes, boy," Wilkinson said, his head still bowed and his voice muffled.
"Shoes?"
"You put them on your feet, young Hook, to keep the mud from getting between your toes."
The leather looked old, dark and shrunken. One reliquary held a shriveled shoe so small that Hook decided it had to be a piece of child's footwear.
"Why shoes?" he asked. "You've heard of St. Crispin and St. Crispinian?"
"No."
"Patron saints of cobblers, boy, and of leather workers. They made those shoes, or so we're told, and they lived here and were probably killed here. Martyred, boy, like that old man you burned in London."
"He was a
heretic, I know, you said, but every martyr was killed because someone stronger disagreed with what he believed, or what she believed. Christ on his cross, boy. Jesus himself was crucified for heresy. Why the hell else do you think they nailed him up? Did you kill women too?"
"I didn't," Hook said uncomfortably.
"But there were women?" Wilkinson asked, looking at Hook.
He saw the answer in Hook's face and grimaced.
"Oh, I'm sure God was delighted with that day's work."
The old man shook his head in disgust before reaching into a purse hanging from his belt. He took out a handful of what Hook presumed were coins and dropped them into the huge copper jar that stood by the altar to receive the tribute of pilgrims. A priest had been watching the two English archers suspiciously, but visibly relaxed when he heard the sound of metal falling onto metal in the big jar.
"Arrowheads," Wilkinson explained with a grin. Old, rusted broadheads that are no good any more. Now why don't you kneel and say a prayer to Crispin and Crispinian?
Hook hesitated. God, he was sure, would have seen Wilkinson drop valueless arrowheads into the jar instead of coins, and the threat of hell's fire suddenly seemed very close, and so Hook hurriedly took a coin from his own pouch and dropped it into the copper jar.
Good lad, Wilkinson said. The bishop will be right glad of that. It'll pay for a sup of his ale, won't it?
Why pray to Crispin and Crispinian? Hook asked Wilkinson.
Because they're the local saints, boy. That's their job, to listen to prayers from Soissons. So they're the best saints to pray to here.
So Hook went on his knees and prayed to St. Crispin and St. Crispinian that they would beg forgiveness for his sin in London. And he prayed that they would keep him safe in this their town of martyrdom and send him home unscathed to England. The prayer did not feel as powerful as those he had addressed to the Mother of Christ, but it made sense, he decided, to pray to the two saints because this was their town and they would surely keep a special watch on those who prayed to them in Soissons.
I'm done, lad, Wilkinson announced briskly.
He was pushing something into his pocket, and Hook, moving to the altar's flank, saw that the frontal's end, where it hung down to the floor, was frayed and ragged because a great square had been crudely cut away. The old man grinned.
Silk, lad, silk. I need silk thread for arrows, so I just stole it. From God? If God can't afford a few threads of silk, boy, then he's in dire trouble. And you should be glad. You want to kill Frenchmen, young Hook? Pray that I have enough silk thread to tie up your arrows.
But Hook had no chance to pray because next day, under the rising sun, the French came. The garrison had known they were coming. News had reached Soissons of the surrender of Compiègne, another town that had been captured by the Burgundians, and Soissons was now the only fortress that barred the French advance into Flanders, where the main Burgundian army lay. And the French army was reported to be coming east along the Aisne. Then suddenly, on a bright summer morning, they were there. Hook watched their arrival from the western ramparts. Horsemen came first. They wore armour and had bright surcoats, and some galloped close to the town as if daring the bowmen on the walls to shoot. Some crossbowmen loosed bolts, but no horseman or horse was hit.
"Save your arrows!"
Smithson, the centener, ordered his English archers. He flicked a careless finger at Hook's strung bow.
"Don't use it, lad," he said. "Don't waste an arrow!"
The centener had come from his tavern, the Goose, and now blinked at the cavorting horsemen, who were shouting inaudibly at the ramparts where men were hanging the Burgundian standards alongside the personal standard of the garrison's commander, the Sieur de Bournonville. Some townsfolk had also come to the walls, and they too gazed at the newly arrived horsemen.
"Look at the bastards," Smithson grumbled, gesturing at the townsfolk. "They'd like to betray us. We should have killed every last one of them. We should have slit their goddamn French throats," he spat. "Nothing will happen for a day. Might as well drink ale while it's still available."
He stumbled away, leaving Hook and a half a dozen other English archers on the wall. All day the French came. Most were on foot, and those men surrounded Soissons' chopped down trees on the low hills to the south. Tents were erected on the cleared land, and beside the tents were the bright standards of the French nobility, a riot of red, blue, gold and silver flags. Barges came up the river, propelled by giant sweeps, and the barges carried four mangonels, huge machines that could hurl rocks at the city walls. Only one of the massive catapults was brought ashore that day, and Enguerrand de Bournonville, thinking to tip it back into the river, led 200 mounted men-at-arms on a sally from the western gate. But the French had expected the attack and sent twice as many horsemen to oppose the Burgundians. The two sides reined in, lances upright, and after a while the Burgundians wheeled back, pursued by French jeers. That afternoon smoke began to thicken as the besieging French burned the houses just outside Soissons' walls. Hook watched the red-headed girl carry a bundle towards the new French encampment. None of the fugitives asked to be admitted to the city, instead they went towards the enemy lines. The girl turned in the thickening smoke to wave farewell to the archers. The first enemy crossbowmen appeared in that smoke, each archer protected by a companion holding a thick pavise, a shield large enough to hide a man as he laboriously recranked the crossbow after each bolt was loosed. The heavy bolts thumped into the walls or whistled overhead to fall somewhere in the city. Then, as the sun began to sink towards the monstrous catapult on the river's bank, a trumpet sounded. It called three times, its notes clear and sharp in the smoke-hazed air, and as the last blast faded, so the crossbowmen ceased shooting. There was a sudden surge of sparks as a thatch roof collapsed into a burning house and the smoke whirled thick along the Campania Road, where Hook saw two horsemen appear. Neither horseman was in armour. Both men instead wore bright-coloured surcoats, and their only weapons were slender white wands that they held aloft as their horses' hides stepped delicately on the rutted road. The Sieur de Bononville must have expected them because the west gate opened and the town's commander rode out with a single companion to meet the approaching riders.
"Heralds," Jack Dancy said.
Dancy was from Herefordshire and was a few years older than Hook. He'd volunteered for service under the Burgundian flag because he'd been caught stealing at home.
"It was either be hanged there or be killed here," he told Hook one night. "What those heralds are doing," he said now, "is telling us to surrender, and that's what we do."
"And be captured by the French?" Hook asked.
"No, no, he's a good fellow."
Dancy nodded at de Bournonville.
"He'll make sure we're safe. If we surrender, they'll let us march away."
"Where to?"
"Wherever they want us to be," Dancy said vaguely.
The heralds, who had been followed at a distance by two standard-bearers and a trumpeter, had met de Bournonville not far from the gate. Hook watched as the men bowed to each other from their saddles. This was the first time he'd seen heralds, but he knew they were never to be attacked. A herald was an observer, a man who watched for his lord and reported what he saw, and an enemy's herald was to be treated with respect. Heralds also spoke for their lords, and these men must have spoken for the King of France, for one of their flags was the French royal banner, a great square of blue silk on which three gold lilies were emblazoned. The other flag was purple with a white cross, and Dancy told him that was the banner of Saint Denis, who was France's patron saint, and Hook wondered whether Denis had more influence in heaven than Crispin and Crispinian. Did they argue their cases before God, he wondered, like two pleaders in a manor court? He touched the wooden cross hanging about his neck. The men spoke for a brief while, then bowed to each other again before the two royal heralds turned their grey horses and rode away. The Sieur de Bournonville watched them for a moment, then wheeled his own horse. He galloped back to the city, curbing beside the dyer's burning house, from where he shouted up at the wall. He spoke French, of which Hook had learned little, but then added some words in English.
"We fight. We do not give France the citadel. We fight, and we will defeat them."
That ringing announcement was greeted by silence as Burgundian and English alike let the words die away without echoing their commander's defiance. Dancy sighed, but said nothing, and then a crossbow bolt whirred overhead to clatter into a nearby street. De Bournonville had waited for a response from his men on the walls, but, receiving none, spurred through the gate, and Hook heard the squeal of its huge hinges, the crash as the timbers closed and the heavy thump as the locking bar was dropped into its brackets. The sun was haze now, shining red-gold and bright through the diffusing smoke, beneath which a party of enemy horsemen rode parallel to the city wall. They were men-at-arms, armoured and helmeted, and one of them, mounted on a great black horse, carried a strange banner that streamed behind him. The banner bore no badge, it was simply a long pennon of the brightest red cloth, a rippling streak of silken blood made almost transparent by the vapour-wrapped sun behind. But the sight of it caused men on the wall to make the sign of the cross.
"The Oriflamme," Dancy said quietly.
"Oriflamme?"
"The French war banner," Dancy said.
He touched his middle finger to his tongue, then crossed himself again.
"It means no prisoners," he said bleakly. "It means they want to kill us all."
He fell backwards. For a heartbeat, Hook did not know what had happened. Then he thought Dancy must have tripped and he instinctively held out a hand to pull him up. And it was then he saw the leather-fledged crossbow bolt jutting from Dancy's forehead. There was very little blood. A few droplets had splattered Dancy's face, which otherwise looked peaceful, and Hook went to one knee and stared at the thick shafted bolt. Less than a hand's breadth protruded. The rest was deep in the Herefordshire man's brain, and Dancy had died without a sound, except for the meat axe noise of the bolt striking home.
"Jack?" Hook asked.
"No good talking to him, Nick,"
one of the other archers said.
"He's chatting to the devil now."
Hook stood and turned. Later he had little memory of what happened, or even why it happened. It was not as though Jack Dancy had been a close friend, for Hook had no such friends in Soissons except perhaps John Wilkinson. Yet there was a sudden anger in Hook. Dancy was an Englishman, and in Soissons the English felt beleaguered as much by their own side as by the enemy. And now Dancy was dead, and so Hook took a varnished arrow from his white linen arrow bag that hung on his right side. He turned and lowered his bow so that it lay horizontally in front of him, and he lay the arrow across the stave and trapped the shaft with his left thumb as he engaged the cord. He swung the long bow upright as his right hand took the arrow's fledged end and drew it back with the cord.
"We're not to shoot,"
one of the archers said.
"Don't waste an arrow,"
another put in. The cord was at Hook's right ear. His eyes searched the smoke-shrouded ground outside the town, and he saw a crossbowman step from behind a pavice decorated with the symbol of crossed axes.
"You can't shoot as far as they can,"
the first archer warned him. But Hook had learned the bow from childhood. He had strengthened himself until he could pull the cord of the largest war bow, and he had taught himself that a man did not aim with the eye, but with the mind. You saw, and then you willed the arrow, and the hands instinctively twitched to point the bow, and the crossbowman was bringing up his heavy weapon as two bolts seared the evening air close to Hook's head. He was oblivious. It was like the moment in the green wood when the deer showed for an instant between the leaves, and the arrow would fly without the archer knowing he had even loosed the string.
"The skill is all between your ears, boy," a villager had told him years before. "All between your ears. You don't aim a bow. You think where the arrow will go, and it goes." Hook released.
"You goddamn fool,"
an archer said, and Hook watched the white goose feathers flicker in the white hazed air and saw the arrow fall faster than a stooping hawk, steel-tipped, silk-bound, ash-shafted, feathered death flying in the evening's quiet.
"Good God," the first archer said quietly.
The crossbowman did not die as easily as Dancy. Hook's arrow pierced his throat, and the man twisted around, and the crossbow released itself so that the bolt spun crazily into the sky as the man fell backwards, still twisting as he fell. Then he thrashed on the ground, hands scrabbling at his throat, where the pain was like liquid fire, and above him the sky was red now, a smoke-hazed blood-red sky, lit by fires and glowing with the sun's daily death. That, Hook thought, had been a good arrow, straight-shafted and properly fledged, with its feathers all plucked from the same goose wing. It had flown true, it had gone where he willed it, and he had killed a man in battle. He could at last call himself an archer. On the evening of the siege's second day, Hook thought the world had ended. It was an evening of warm and limpid light. The air was pale bright, and the river slid gently between its flowery banks where willows and alders grew. The French banners hung motionless above their tents. Some smoke still sifted from the burned houses to rise soft into the evening air until it faded high in the cloudless sky. Martins and swallows hunted beside the city's wall, swooping and twisting. Nicholas Hook leaned on the ramparts. His unstrung bow was propped beside him as his thoughts drifted back to England, to the manor, to the field behind the long barn, where the hay would be almost ready for cutting. There would be hares in the long grass, trout in the stream, and larks in the twilight. He thought about the decaying cattle byre in the field called Shortmead, the byre with rotting thatch and a screen of honeysuckle behind which William Snowball's young wife Nell would meet him and make silent, desperate love. He wondered who was coppicing the three-button wood, and for the thousandth time how the wood had got its name. The tavern in the village was called the Three Buttons, and no one knew why, not even Lord Slayton, who sometimes limped on crutches beneath the tavern's lintel and put silver on the serving hatch to buy all present an ale. Then Hook thought of the perils malevolent and ever-present. He could not go home now, not ever, because he was an outlaw. The perils could kill him, and it would not be murder, not even manslaughter, because an outlaw was beyond the law's help. He remembered the window in the London stable, and knew God had told him to take the Lollard girl through that window, but he had failed, and he thought he must be cut off from the heavenly light beyond the window for ever. Sarah, he often murmured her name aloud, as though the repetition could bring forgiveness. The evening peace vanished in noise. But first there was light. Dark light, Hook thought later, a stab of dark light. Flame-black, red light that licked like a hell's serpent's tongue from an earthwork the French had dug close to one of their gaunt catapults. The tongue of wicked fire was visible for an instant before it was obliterated in a thundercloud of dense, black smoke that billowed sudden, and then the noise came, an ear-punching blow of sound that shook the heavens to be followed by another crack, almost as loud, as something struck the city wall. The wall shook. Hook's bow toppled and clattered onto the stones. Birds were screaming as they flew from the flame, smoke and lingering noise. The sun was gone, hidden by the black cloud, and Hook stared and was convinced, at least for a moment, that a crack had opened in the earth and that the fires of hell had vomited their way to the surface.
"Sweet bloody Christ!"
an archer said in awe.
"Was wondering when that would happen," another archer said in disgust. "A gun," he explained to the first man. "Have you never seen a gun?"
"Never!"
"You'll see them now," the second man said grimly.
Hook had never seen a gun either, and he flinched when a second one fired to add its filthy smoke to the summer sky. Next day another four cannons added their fire, and the six French guns did far more damage than the four big wooden machines. The catapults were inaccurate, and their jagged boulders often missed the ramparts and dropped into the city to crush houses that started burning as their kitchen fires were scattered. But the gunstones ate steadily at the city wall, which was already in bad repair. It took only 2 days for the outer face of the wall to crumble into the wide, fetid ditch, and then the gunners systematically widened the breach as the Burgundians countered by making a semicircular barricade behind the disintegrating wall. Each gun fired 3 times a day, their shots as regular as the bells of a monastery calling men to prayer. The Burgundians had their own gun, which had been mounted on a southern bastion in the expectation that the French would attack from the Paris road, and it took 2 days to drag the weapon to the western ramparts, where it was slung up onto the roof of the gate tower. Hook was fascinated by its tube, which was twice as long as his bow stave, and hooped like an ale pot. The tube and its bindings were made of dark, pitted iron and rested on a squat wooden carriage. The gunners were Dutchmen who spent a long time watching the enemy guns and funnily aimed their tube at one of those French cannon and then set about the laborious task of loading their machine. Gunpowder was put into the barrel with a long-handled ladle, then tamped tight with a cloth-wrapped rammer. Soft loam was added next. The loam was puddled in a wide wooden pail, rammed onto the powder, then left to dry as the gunners sat in a circle and played dice. The gunstone, a boulder chipped into a crude ball, waited beside the tube until the chief gunner, a portly man with a forked beard, decided the loam was dry enough, and only then was the stone pushed down the long hooped barrel. A wooden wedge was shoved after it and hammered into place to keep the shaped boulder tight against the loam and powder. A priest sprinkled holy water on the gun and said a prayer as the Dutchman used long levers to make a final small adjustment to the tube's aim.
"Stand back, boy,"
Sergeant Smithson told Hook. The sentinel had deigned to leave the Goose Tavern to watch the Dutchman fire their weapon. A score of other men had also arrived, including the Sieur de Bournonville, who called encouragement to the gunners. None of the spectators stood close to the gun, but instead watched as if the black tube were a wild beast that could not be trusted.
"Good morning, Sir Roger,"
Smithson said, knuckling his forehead towards a tall, arrow-thin man. Sir Roger Palais, commander of the English contingent, ignored the greeting. He had a narrow, beak-nosed face with a lantern jaw, dark hair, and in the company of his archers the expression of a man forced to endure the stench of a latrine. The portly Dutchman waited till the priest had finished his prayer, then he pushed a stripped quill into a small hole that had been drilled into the gun's breech. He used a copper funnel to fill the quill with powder, squinted one more time down the length of the barrel, then stepped to one side and held out a hand for a long burning taper. The priest, the only man other than the artilleryman to be close to the weapon, made the sign of the cross and spoke a quick blessing. Then the chief gunner touched the flame to the powder-filled quill. The gun exploded. Instead of sending its stone ball screaming across to the French siege works, the cannon vanished in a welter of smoke, flying metal and shredded flesh. The five gunners and the priest were killed instantly, turned to blood-red mist and ribboned meat. A man-at-arms screamed and writhed as red-hot metal sliced into his belly. Sir Roger, who had been standing next to the screaming man, stepped fastidiously away and grimaced at the blood that had spattered across the badge on his surcoat. That badge showed three hawks on a green field.
"Tonight, Smithson, you will meet me after sundown in San Antoine Le Petit Church. You and your whole company."
"Yes, sir, yes," Smithson said faintly. "Of course, Sir Roger."
The sergeant was staring at the ruined cannon. The first 10 feet of the shattered barrel lay canted and ripped open, while the breech had been torn into jagged shards of smoking metal. Part of a hoop and a man's hand lay by Hook's feet, while the gunners, hired at great expense, were nothing but eviscerated carcasses. The Sieur de Bournonville, his jupon splattered with blood and scraps of flesh, made the sign of the cross, while derisive jeers sounded from the French siege lines.
"We must plan for the assault," Sir Roger said, apparently oblivious to the wet horror a few paces away.
"Very good, Sir Roger," Smithson said.
The sentinel scooped a jellied mess from his belt.
"A Dutchman's goddamn brains," he said in disgust, flicking the gob towards Sir Roger, who had turned and now strode away.
Sir Roger, with three men-at-arms all wearing his badge of the Three Hawks, met the English and Welsh archers of the Soissons garrison in the church of San Antoine Le Petit just after sunset. Sir Roger's surcoat had been washed, though the bloodstains were still faintly visible on the green linen. He stood in front of the altar, lit by the guttering rushlights that burned feebly in brackets mounted on the church pillars, and his face still bore the distant look of a man pained to be in his present company.
"Your job," he said without any preamble once the 89 archers had settled on the floor of the nave, "will be to defend the breach. I cannot tell you when the enemy will assault, but I can assure you it will be soon. I trust you will repel any such assault." "Oh, we will, Sir Roger," Smithson put in helpfully. "Rely on it, sir."
Sir Roger's long face shuddered at the comment. Rumour in the English contingent said that he had borrowed money from Italian bankers in expectation of inheriting an estate from an uncle, but the land had passed to a cousin, and Sir Roger had been left owing a fortune to unforgiving Lombards. The only hope of paying the debt was to capture and ransom a rich French knight, which was presumably why he had sold his services to the Duke of Burgundy.
"In the event," he said, "that you fail to keep the enemy out of the city, you are to gather here in this church."
Those words caused a stir as men frowned and looked at each other. If they failed to defend the breach and lost the new defences behind it, then they expected to retreat to the castle.
"Sir Roger,"
Smithson ventured hesitantly.
"I had not invited questions," Sir Roger said. "Of your goodness, Sir Roger,"
Smithson persevered, knuckling his forehead as he spoke.
"But wouldn't we be safer in the castle?"
"You will assemble here in this church," Sir Roger said firmly.
"Why not the castle?"
an archer near Hook demanded belligerently. Sir Roger paused, searching the dim nave for whoever had spoken. He could not discover the questioner, but deigned to offer an answer anyway.
"The townspeople," he finally spoke, "detest us. If you attempt to reach the castle, you will be assaulted in the streets. This place is much closer to the breach, so come here." He paused again. "I shall endeavour to arrange a truce for you."
There was an uncomfortable silence. Sir Roger's explanation made some sense. The archers knew that most folk in Soissons hated them. The townspeople were French. They supported their king and hated the Burgundians, but they hated the English even more, and so it was more than likely that they would assault the archers retreating towards the castle.
A truce? Smithson said dubiously.
The French quarrel is with Burgundy, Sir Roger said, not with us.
Will you be joining us, Sir Roger?
An archer called out.
Of course,
Sir Roger said. He paused, but no one spoke.
Fight well, he said distantly. And remember, you are Englishmen.
Welshmen,
someone intervened. Sir Roger visibly flinched at that and then, without another word, led his three men-at-arms from the church. A chorus of protest sounded as he left. The church of Saint-Antoine-le-Petit was stone-built and defensible, but not nearly so safe as the castle. Though it was true the castle was at the other end of the town, and Hook wondered how difficult it would be to reach that refuge if townsfolk were blocking the streets and French men-at-arms were howling through the breached ramparts. He looked up at the painted wall that showed men, women and children tumbling into hell. There were priests and even bishops among the doomed souls who fell in the screaming cascade to a lake of fire where black devils waited with leering grins and triple-barbed eel spears.
"You'll wish you were in hell if the Frenchies capture you," Smithson said, noticing where Hook was looking. "You'll all be begging for the comforts of hell if those French bastards catch you. So remember, we fight at the barricade, and then, if it all goes to shit, we come here."
"Why here?"
a man called out.
"Because Sir Roger knows what he's doing," Smithson said, sounding anything but certain. "And if you've got sweethearts here," he went on with a leer, "make certain the little darlings come with you."
He began thrusting his meaty hips backwards and forwards.
"Don't want our sweethearts left in the streets to be humped by half the French army, do we?"
Next morning, as he did each morning, Hook gazed north across the Aisne to the low wooded hills where the beleaguered garrison hoped to see a Burgundian relief force. None came. The great gun stones whirred across the ashes of the burned houses and bit into the crumbling wall to start up their clouds of dust that settled on the river to drift seawards like pale grey stains on the water. Hook rose early every morning, before it was light, and went to the cathedral, where he knelt and prayed. He'd been warned not to walk the streets by himself, but the people of Soissons left him alone, perhaps scared of his height and size, or perhaps because they knew he was the one archer who prayed regularly, and so tolerated him. He had abandoned praying to St. Crispin and St. Crispinian, because he reckoned they cared more about the townsfolk, their own folk, and so he prayed instead to the Mother of Christ because his own mother had been called Mary, and he begged the Blessed Virgin for forgiveness because of the girl who had died in London. On one such morning, a priest knelt beside him. Hook ignored the man.
"You're the Englishman who prays,"
the priest said in English, stumbling over the unfamiliar language. Hook said nothing.
"They wonder why you pray,"
the priest went on, jerking his head to indicate the women who knelt before other statues and altars. Hook's instinct was to go on ignoring the man, but the priest had a friendly face and a kindly voice.
"I'm just praying," he said, sounding surly. "Are you praying for yourself?"
"Yes," Hook admitted. He prayed so that God would forgive him and lift the curse that he was certain blighted his life.
"Then ask something for someone else," the priest suggested gently. "God listens to those prayers more readily, I think, and if you pray for someone else, then he will grant your own request too."
He smiled, stood and lightly touched Hook's shoulder.
"And pray to our saints, Crispin and Crispinia. I think they are less busy than the Blessed Virgin. God watch over you, Englishman."
The priest walked away and Hook decided to take his advice and pray again to the two local saints, and so he went to an altar beneath a painting of the two martyrs, and there he prayed for the soul of Sarah, whose life he had failed to save in London. He stared up at the painting as he prayed. The two saints stood in a green field scattered with golden stars on a hill high above a white-walled city. They looked gravely and a little sadly towards Hook. They did not look like shoemakers. They were dressed in white robes, and Crispin carried a shepherd's crook, while Crispinian held a wicker tray of apples and pears. Their names were painted beneath each man, and Hook, though he could not read, could tell which saint was which because one name was longer than the other. Crispinian looked much the friendlier man. He had a rounder face and blue eyes and a half-smile of great kindliness, while St. Crispin appeared much sterner and was half-turned away, as though he had no time for an onlooker and was about to walk down the hill and into the city, and so Hook fell into the habit of praying to Crispinian each morning, though he always acknowledged Crispin too. He dropped 2 pennies in the jar each time he prayed.
"She'll look at you," John Wilkinson said one evening. "I wouldn't take you for a man of prayer."
"I wasn't," Hook said. "Till now."
"Writing for your soul?" the old archer asked.
Hook hesitated. He was binding arrow fledging with the silk stolen from the cathedral's altar frontal.
"I heard a voice," he blurted out suddenly.
"A voice?"
Wilkinson asked. Hook said nothing.
"God's voice?" the older man asked.
"It was in London," Hook said. He felt foolish for his admission, but Wilkinson took it seriously. He stared at Hook for a long time, then nodded abruptly.
"You're a lucky man, Nicholas Hook."
"I am?"
"If God spoke to you, then he must have a purpose for you. That means you might survive this siege."
"If it was God who spoke to me," Hook said, embarrassed.
"Why shouldn't he? He needs to speak to people on account that the church don't listen to him."
"It doesn't." Wilkinson spat.
"The church is about money, lad, money. Priests are supposed to be shepherds, aren't they? They're meant to be looking after the flock, and they're all in the manor hall stuffing their faces with pastries so the sheep have to look after themselves."
He pointed an arrow at Hook.
"And if the French break into the town, Hook, don't go to St. Anthony the Lesser. Go to the castle."
"Sir Roger," Hook began.
"Wants us dead," Wilkinson said angrily.
"Why would he want that?"
"Because he's got no money and a heap of debt, boy, so the man with the biggest purse can buy him. And because he's not a real Englishman. His family came to England with the Normans and he hates you and me because we're Saxons. And because he's crammed to the throat with Norman shit, that's why. You go to the castle, lad, that's what you do."
The next few nights were dark, and the waning moon was a sliver like a cutthroat's blade. The Sieur de Bournonville feared a night attack and ordered dogs to be tethered out in the wasteland where the houses had been burned. If the dogs barked, he said, the warning bell on the western gate was to be rung, and the dogs did bark and the bell was rung, but no Frenchman assaulted the breach. Instead, as the dawn mist shimmered above the river, the besiegers catapulted the dogs' corpses into the town. The animals had been gelded and had their throats cut as a warning of the fate that awaited the defiant garrison. The feast of St. Abdus passed, and no relief force arrived, and then St. Posidius's feast came and went, and next day was the feast of the 7 Holy Virgins, and Hook prayed to each one, and in the next dawn he sent a plea to St. Dunstan, the Englishman, on his feast day, and the day after that to St. Ethelbert, who had been a king of England, and all the time he also prayed to Crispinian and to Crispin, begging their protection, and on the very next day, on the feast day of St. Hospitius, he received his answer. When the French who had been praying to St. Denis attacked Soissons. The first Hook knew of the assault was the sound of the city's church bells clanging in frantic haste and jangling disorder. It was dark and he was momentarily confused. He slept on straw at the back of John Wilkinson's workshop and he woke to the glare of flames leaping high as the old man threw wood on the brazier to provide light.
"Don't lie there like a pregnant sow, boy," Wilkinson said. "They're here."
"Mary, Mother of God."
Hook felt the surge of panic like icy water seething through his body.
"I've an inkling she don't care one way or the other," Wilkinson said.
He was pulling on a mail coat, struggling to get the heavy links over his head.
"There's an arrow bag by the door," he went on,
his voice now muffled by the coat.
"Full of straight ones. Left it for you. Go, boy. Kill some bastards."
"What about you?"
Hook asked. He was tugging on his boots, new boots made by a skilled cobbler of Soissons.
"I'll catch up with you.
String your bow, son, and go.
Hook buckled his sword belt, strung his bow, snatched his arrow bag, then took the second bag from beside the door and ran into the tavern yard. He could hear shouting and screams, but where they came from he could not tell. Archers were pouring into the yard, and he instinctively followed them towards the new defences behind the breach. The church bells were hammering the night sky with jangling noises. Dogs barked and howled. Hook had no armour except for an ancient helmet that Wilkinson had given him and which sat on his head like a bowl. He had a padded jacket that might stop a feeble sword swing, but that was his only protection. Other archers had short mail coats and close-fitting helmets, but they all wore Burgundy's brief surcoat blazoned with the jagged red cross, and Hook saw those liveries lining the new wall that was made of wicker baskets filled with earth. None of the archers was drawing a cord yet. Instead, they just looked towards the breach that flared with sudden light as Burgundian men-at-arms threw pitch-soaked torches into the gap of the gun-ravaged wall. There were close to 50 men-at-arms at the new wall, but no enemy in the breach. Yet the bell still ran frantically to announce a French attack, and Hook swung around to see a glow in the sky above the city's southern rooftops, a glow that flickered lurid on the cathedral's tower as evidence that buildings burned somewhere near the Paris Gate. Was that where the French attacked? The Paris Gate was commanded by Sir Roger Palais and defended by the English men-at-arms, and Hook wondered, not for the first time, why Sir Roger had not demanded that the English archers join that gate's garrison. Instead, the archers waited by the western breach where still no enemy appeared. Smithson, the sentinel, was nervous. He kept fingering the silver chain that denoted his rank and glancing towards the glow of the southern fires, then back to the breach.
"Devil's turd," he said, of no one in particular.
"What's happening?" an archer demanded.
"How in God's name would I know?"
Smithson snarled.
"I think they're already inside the city," John Wilkinson said mildly.
He had bought a dozen sheaves of spare arrows that he now dropped behind the archers. The sound of screams came from somewhere in the city, and a troop of Burgundian crossbowmen ran past Hook, abandoning the breach and heading towards the Paris Gate. Some of the men-at-arms followed them.
"If they're inside the town," Smithson said uncertainly, "then we should go to the church."
"Not to the castle?"
a man demanded.
"We go to the church, I think," Smithson said. "As Sir Roger says, he's gentry, isn't he? He must know what he's doing."
"Aye, and the Pope lays eggs," Wilkinson commented.
"Now?"
a man asked.
"We go now?"
But Smithson said nothing. He just tugged at the silver chain and looked left and right. Hook was staring at the breach. His heart was beating hard, his breathing was shallow, and his right leg trembled.
"Help me, God," he prayed. "Sweet Jesu, protect me." But he got no comfort from the prayer. All he could think of was that the enemy was in Soissons, or attacking Soissons, and he did not know what was happening, and he felt vulnerable and helpless. The bells banged inside his head, confusing him. The wide breach was dark except for the feeble flicker of dying flames from the torches, but slowly Hook became aware of other lights moving there, of shifting silver-grey lights, lights like smoke in moonlight or like the ghosts who came to earth on All Hallows' Eve. The lights, Hook thought, were beautiful. They were filmy and vaporous in the darkness. He stared, wondering what the glowing shapes were, and then the silver-grey wreaths turned to red and he realized with a start of fear that the shifting shapes were men. He was seeing the light of the torches reflected from plate armor.
"Sergeant,"
he shouted.
"What is it?"
Smithson snapped back.
"The bastards are here,"
Hook called. And so they were. The bastards were coming through the breach. Their plate armour was scoured bright enough to reflect the firelight, and they were advancing beneath a banner of blue on which golden lilies blossomed. Their visors were closed and their long swords flashed back the flamelight. They were no longer vaporous, now they resembled men of burning metal. Phantoms from the dreams of hell, death coming through the dark to Soissons. Hook could not count them, they were so many.
"Oh my God, shit," Smithson said in panic. "Stop them!"
Hook did what he was told. He stepped back to the barricade, plucked an arrow from the linen bag, and laid it on the bow's stave. The fear was suddenly gone, or else had been pushed aside by the certain knowledge of what needed to be done. Hook needed to haul back the bow's cord. Most grown men in the prime of their strength could not pull a war bow's cord back to the ear. Most men-at-arms, despite being toughened by war and hardened by constant sword exercises, could only draw the hemcord halfway, but Hook made it look easy. His arm flowed back, his eye sought a mark for the arrow's bright head, and he did not even think as he released. He was already reaching for the second arrow as the first, a shaft-weighted bodkin, slapped through a breastplate of shining steel and threw the man back onto the French standard-bearer. And Hook loosed again, not thinking, only knowing that he had been told to stop this attack. He loosed shaft after shaft. He drew the cord to his right ear and was not aware of the tiny shifts his left hand made to send the white feathered arrows on their short journey from cord to victim. He was not aware of the deaths he caused or the injuries he gave, or of the arrows that glanced off armour to spin uselessly away. Most were not useless. The long bodkin heads could easily punch through armour at this close range, and Hook was stronger than most archers, who were stronger than most men, and his bow was heavy. John Wilkinson, when he had first met Hook, had drawn the younger man's bow and failed to get the cord past his chin, and he had given Hook a glance of respect. And now that long, thick-bellied bow, cut from the trunk of a yew in far-off Savoy, was sending death through the bell-ringing dark, except that Hook was only seeing the enemy who came across the breach where the guttering torches burned, and he did not notice the dark floods of men who surged at either edge of the wall's gap and who were already tugging at the wicker baskets. Then part of the barricade collapsed, and the noise made Hook turn to see that he was the only archer left at the defences. The breach, despite the dead who lay there and the injured who crawled there, was filled with howling men. The night was lit by fire, flame red, riddled with smoke and loud with war shouts. Hook realised then that John Wilkinson had shouted at him to run, but in the moment's excitement the warning had not lodged in Hook's mind, but now it did. He plucked up the arrow bag and ran. Men howled behind him as the barricade fell and the French swarmed across its remnants and into the city. Hook understood then how the deer felt when the hounds were in every thicket and men were beating the undergrowth and arrows were whickering through the leaves. He had often wondered if an animal could know what death was. They knew fear and they knew defiance, but beyond fear and defiance came the gut-emptying panic, the last moments of life, as the hunters close in and the heart races and the mind slithers frantically. Hook felt that panic and ran. At first he just ran. The bells were still crashing, dogs were howling, men were roaring war shouts and horns were calling. He ran into a small square, a space where leather merchants usually displayed their hides, and it was oddly deserted, but then he heard the sounds of bolts being shot and he understood that folk were hiding in their houses and barring the doors. Crashes announced where soldiers were kicking or beating those locked doors down. Go to the castle, he thought, and he ran that way, but turned a corner to see the wide space in front of the cathedral filled with men in unfamiliar liveries, their surcoats lit by the torches they carried, and he doubled back like a deer recoiling from hounds. He decided to go to St. Antoine Le Petit's church and sprinted down an alley, twisted into another, ran across the open space in front of the city's biggest nunnery, then turned down the street where the Goose Tavern stood and saw still more men in their strange liveries, and those men blocked his way to the church. They spotted him and a growl sounded, and the growl turned into a triumphant howl as they ran towards him, and Hook, desperate as any doomed animal, bolted into an alley, leaped at the wall that blocked the end, sprawled over into a small yard that stank of sewage, scrambled across a second wall, and then, surrounded by shouts and quivering with fear, he sank into a dark corner and waited for the end. A hunted deer would do that. When it saw no escape, it would freeze, shiver, and wait for the death it must sense. Now Hook shivered. Better to kill yourself, John Wilkinson had said, than be caught by the French. And so Hook felt for his knife. But he could not draw it. He could not kill himself. And so he waited to be killed. Then he realized his pursuers had evidently abandoned the chase. There was so much plunder for them in Soissons, and so many victims, that one fugitive did not interest them, and Hook, slowly recovering his senses, realized he'd found a temporary refuge. He was in one of the Goose's backyards, a place where the brewery barrels were washed and repaired. A door of the tavern suddenly opened, and a flaming torch illuminated the trestles and staves and tuns. A man peered into the yard, said something dismissive, and went back into the tavern where a woman screamed. Hook stayed where he was. He dared not move. The city was full of women screaming now, full of horsemail laughter and full of children crying. A cat stalked past him. The church bells had long ceased their clangor. He knew he could not stay where he was. Dawn would reveal him. Oh God, oh God, oh God, he prayed, unaware that he prayed. Be with me now and at the hour of my death. He shivered. Hooves sounded in the street beyond the brewery yard wall. A man laughed, a woman whimpered. Clouds scurried across the moon's face, and for some reason Hook thought of the badges on Beggar's Hill, and that homely thought calmed the panic. He stood. Perhaps there was a chance he could reach the church. It was much closer than the castle, and Sir Roger had promised to make an attempt to save the archers' lives, and, though it seemed a slender hope, it was all Hook could think of doing, and so he pulled himself up the yard's wall to peer over the top. The Goose's stables were next door. No noise came from them, and so he climbed onto the wall, and from there he could step onto the stable roof that trembled under his weight. But by staying on the rooftop, where the ridge beam ran, he could shuffle until he reached the further gable, where he dropped into a dark alley. He was shaking again, knowing he was more vulnerable here. He moved silently, slowly, until he could peer about the alley's corner to where the church lay. And he saw there was no escape. The church of Saint Antoine le Petit was guarded by enemies. There were over 30 men-at-arms and a dozen crossbowmen in the open space in front of the church steps, all in liveries that Hook had not seen before. If Smithson and the archers were inside the church, then they were safe enough, for they could defend the door, but it seemed plain to Hook that the enemy must be there to prevent any archer escaping, and he assumed they would stop any stray archer trying to approach the church. He thought of running for the doorway, but guessed it would be locked, and that, while he was beating on the heavy timber, the crossbowmen would use him for a target. The enemy was not just guarding the church. They had fetched barrels from some tavern and were drinking, and they had stripped two girls naked and tied them across the two barrels with their legs spread wide, and now the men took it in turns to hitch up their mail coats and rape the girls, who lay silent as if they had been emptied of moans and tears. The city was loud with women screaming, and the sound scored across Hook's conscience like an arrowhead scraping on slate. And perhaps that was why he did not move, but instead stood at the corner like an animal that had no place to run or hide. Hook wondered if the girls were dead. They were so still. But then the nearest turned her head, and Hook remembered Sarah and flinched with guilt. The girl, who looked no older than 12 or 13, stared dully into the dark as a man jerked and grunted at her. Then a door opened onto the alley, and a flood of light washed across Hook, who turned to see a man-at-arms stagger into the mud. The man wore a surcoat showing a silver wheat sheaf on a green field. The man fell to his knees and vomited as a second man, in the same livery, came to the door and laughed. It was that second man who saw Hook and recognized the great war bow, and so put his hand on his sword's hilt. Hook reacted in panic. He thrust the bow at the man with the sword. In his head he was screaming, unable to think, but the lunge had all his archer's strength in it, and the horn knock of the bow's tip pierced the man-at-arms' throat before his sword was even half-drawn. Blood misted black, and still Hook thrust so that the bow ripped clean through windpipe and muscle, skin and sinew, to strike the door jamb. The kneeling man was roaring, spraying vomit as he clawed at Hook, who, still in panic, made a mewing noise of utter despair as he let go of the bow and thrust his hand at his new assailant. He felt his fingers crush eyeballs, and the man began to scream, and Hook was dimly aware that the rapists outside the church were coming for him, and he scrambled through the door, half tripping on the first man who lay trying to pull the bow from his ruptured throat as Hook ran across a room, burst through another door, down a passage, a third door, and he was in a yard, still not thinking, over a wall, a second wall, and there were shouts behind him and screams around him, and he was in absolute terror now. He'd lost his great U-bow and had dropped the arrow bags, though he still had the sword every archer was expected to wear. He'd never used it. He still wore the ragged red cross of Burgundy too, and he began to tear at the surcoat, trying to rid himself of the symbol as he looked desperately for an escape, any escape. Then he scrambled over a stone wall into an alley shadowed by the overhanging houses, but in the dark he saw an open door and ran to it. The door led into a large, empty room where a guttering lantern showed a dead man sprawled across a cushioned wooden bench. The man's blood had sheeted across the flagstones. A tapestry hung on one wall, and there were cupboards and a long table holding an abacus and sheets of parchment that were speared on a tall spike. Hook reckoned the dead man must have been a merchant. In one corner, a ladder climbed to a higher floor, and Hook went up quickly to find a plastered chamber that held a wooden bed with a pallet and blankets. A second ladder led into the attic, and he clambered up and pulled the ladder into the space beneath the rafters and cursed himself for not having done the same with the first ladder. Too late now. He dared not drop back into the house, and so he crouched in the bat droppings beneath the thatch. He was still shaking. Men were shouting in the houses beneath him, and for a time it seemed he must be discovered. And that discovery seemed imminent when someone climbed into the room where the bed stood. But the man only glanced briefly about before leaving, and the rest of the searchers grew bored or else found other quarry. For after a while their excited shouting died. The screaming went on. Indeed, the screaming became louder, and it seemed to Hook, listening in puzzlement, that a whole group of women were just outside the house, all shrieking, and he flinched at the sound. He thought of Sarah in London, of Sir Martin the priest, and of the men he had just seen who had looked so bored as they raped their two silent victims. The screaming turned into sobbing, broken only by men's laughter. Hook was shivering, not with cold, but with fear and guilt, and then he shrank into the small space under the sloping rafters because the room beneath was suddenly lit by a lantern. The light leaked through the attic's crude floorboards that were loosely laid over untrimmed beams. A man had climbed into the room and was shouting down the ladder to other men, and then a woman cried and there was the sound of a slap.
"You're a pretty one," the man said, and Hook was so frightened that he did not even notice that the man spoke English.
"No,"
the woman whimpered.
"Too pretty to share. You're all mine, girl."
Hook peered through a crack in the boards. He could see a wide-brimmed helmet that half obscured the man's shoulders, and then he saw that the woman was a white-robed nun who crouched in the corner of the room. She was whimpering.
"Jesus," she cried. "Marie, mère de Dieu."
And the last word turned into a scream as the man drew a knife.
"No!"
she shouted.
"No! No! No!"
And the helmeted man slapped her hard enough to silence her as he pulled her upright. He put the knife at her neck, then slashed so that her habit was sliced down the front. He ripped the blade further and, despite her struggles, tore the white robe away from her and then cut at her undergarments. He threw her ruined clothes down to the lower floor, and when she was naked, pushed her onto the pallet where she curled into a ball and sobbed.
"Oh, I'm sure God was delighted with that day's work," the voice said, though no one spoke aloud because the voice was in Hook's head.
The words were those John Wilkinson had used to Hook in the cathedral, but the voice did not belong to the old archer. It was a richer, deeper voice full of warmth, and Hook had a sudden vision of a white-robed man smiling and carrying a tray heaped with pears and apples. It was Crispinian, the saint to whom he had addressed most of his prayers in Soissons, and now those prayers were being answered in Hook's head, and in Hook's head Crispinian looked sadly at him, and Hook understood that heaven had given him a chance to make amends. The nun in the room below had cried to Christ's mother, and the Virgin must have spoken to the saints of Soissons who now spoke to Hook. But Hook was frightened. He was hearing voices again. He did not know it, but he was kneeling, and no wonder, God was speaking to him through St. Crispinian. And Nicholas Hook, outlaw and archer, did not know what to do when God spoke to him. He was filled with terror. The man in the room below threw down his helmet. He unbuckled his sword belt and tossed it aside. Then he growled something at the girl before starting to haul his mail coat and its covering surcoat over his head. Hook, peering between the crude floorboards, recognised the badge on the surcoat as Sir Roger Palais's three hawks on a green field. What was that badge doing here? It was the victorious besiegers, not the defeated garrison, yet the three hawks was unmistakably Sir Roger's arms.
"Now," St. Crispinian said. Hook did not move. "Now," St. Crispin snarled in Hook's head.
St. Crispin was not as friendly as Crispinian, and Hook flinched when the saint snapped the word. The man, Hook was not sure whether it was Sir Roger himself or one of his men-at-arms, was struggling with a heavy leather-lined mail coat that was half over his head and constricting his arms.
"For God's sake," Crispinian appealed to Hook. "Do it, boy," St. Crispin said harshly. "Save your soul, Nicholas," Crispinian said gently.
and Hook saved his soul. He dropped through the hole in the attic floor. He forgot his sword, instead drawing the thick-bladed knife that he had once used to eviscerate deer carcasses. He fell just behind the man, who could not see because his mail coat was over his head, but he heard Hook's arrival and he turned just as Hook's blade ripped across his belly. Nicholas Hook gutted the man. The strength of an archer's right arm was in the cut, and the blade went deep and the gut slithered out like wet eels sliding from a slit sack as the man gave a strangulated cry that was muffled by the heavy coat shrouding his head. And he cried again as the knife gave a second cut, upwards this time, as Hook pushed his knife hand deep into the man's ruined belly to drive the blade up under the ribcage to find and puncture the would-be rapist's heart. The man dropped back onto the bed and was dead before he hit the pallet. And Hook, blood wet to his elbow, stared down at his victim. He realized later that the down-filled pallet had saved his life, for it soaked up the blood that otherwise would have dripped through the floorboards to alarm the men beneath. There were two of them, both wearing Sir Roger's livery, but Hook, standing in fear over his victim, noticed that the dead man's surcoat was made of finely woven linen, much finer than the usual cheap surcoat. He moved away from the hatch in the floor. The two men were ransacking a store cupboard and seemed oblivious of the killing that had just occurred above their heads. The dead man's mail coat was tight-linked and polished, studded with the buckles that had anchored his plate armour. Hook crouched and tugged the coat clear of the man's head and saw that he had killed Sir Roger Palaire. Sir Roger, ostensibly a Burgundian ally, had been left alive to rape and steal, which surely meant that Sir Roger had been secretly on the side of the French. Hook tried to comprehend that betrayal, while the naked girl stared at him with eyes and mouth wide open. She looked scared, and Hook feared she was about to scream, and so he put a finger to his lips, but she shook her head and suddenly began to make small, desperate noises, half moans, half gasps, and Hook frowned at first, then understood that silence was more suspicious than the noise of her distress. That was clever of her, he thought. He nodded at her, then cut away a blood-drenched purse attached to Sir Roger's belt. He also pulled Sir Roger's surcoat clear of the mail coat and tossed it with the purse into the attic, then reached up and gripped one of the beams. He pulled himself into the roof space, then stretched his right arm for the girl. She turned away and Hook hissed at her to come with him, but the girl knew what she wanted. She spat at Sir Roger's corpse, then spat a second time before giving Hook her hand. He pulled her up as easily as he hauled back a bowstring. He gestured at the surcoat and purse and she scooped them up, then followed him along the attic. He pushed through the flimsy wattled screen that divided the roof space and so led her into the neighbouring attic. He trod carefully as the light diminished. He went to the very end, three houses down from where he'd killed Sir Roger, and he gestured at the girl again, motioning her to crouch by the gable wall, and then, working slowly so as to make as little noise as possible, he pulled down the roof thatch. It took maybe an hour. He not only dragged down the thatch, but forced some pegged rafters off the ridge timber, and when he had finished, he reckoned it looked as though the roof had collapsed, and he and the girl crept under the straw and timbers and huddled there. He had made a hiding place, and all he could do was wait. The girl sometimes spoke, but Hook had learned little French during his stay in Soissons, and he did not understand what she said. He hushed her, and after a while she leaned against him and fell asleep, though sometimes she would whimper and Hook awkwardly tried to soothe her. She was wearing Sir Roger's surcoat, still damp with his blood. Hook untied the purse's strings and saw coins, gold and silver, the price, he suspected, of betrayal. Dawn was smoky grey. Sir Roger's gutted corpse was found before the sun came up, and there was a great hue and cry, and Hook heard the men ransacking the row of houses beneath him, but his hiding place was cunningly made, and no one thought to look in the tangle of straw and timber. The girl woke then, and Hook laid a finger on her lips, and she shivered as she clung to him. Hook's fear was still there, but it had settled into a resignation, and somehow the company of the girl gave him a hope that had not been in his soul the night before. Or perhaps, he thought, the twin saints of Soissons were protecting him, and he made the sign of the cross and sent a prayer of gratitude to Crispin and Crispinian. They were silent now, but he had done what they had told him to do, and then he wondered if it had been Crispinian who had spoken to him in London. That seemed unlikely, but who had it been? God? Yet that question was unimportant against his realization that he had done what he had failed to do in London, and so hope flickered inside him, hope of redemption and survival. It was a feeble hope, small as a candle's flame in a high wind, but it was there. The city had become quieter as the dawn approached, but as the sun rose over the cathedral, the noise began again. There were screams and moans and cries. There was a gap in the ragged collapsed thatch, and Hook could see down into the small square in front of the church of Saint Antoine le Petit. The two girls who had been tied to the barrels were gone, though the crossbowmen and men-at-arms were still there. A bridal dog sniffed at the corpse of a nun who lay with her head in a pool of black blood and with her habit pulled up above her waist. A man-at-arms rode through the square, a naked girl draped belly down across the saddle in front of him. He slapped her rump two-handed, as though he played a drum, and the watching men laughed. Hook waited. He needed to piss badly, but dared not move, so he wet his breeches and the girl smelt it and grimaced, but had to pee herself a moment later. She began to cry softly, and Hook held her close until her tears stopped. She murmured to him, and he murmured back, and neither understood the other, but both were comforted. Then the sound of more hooves made Hook twist around to peer through a gap in the straw. He could see down to the square where a score or more of horsemen had arrived in front of the church. One man carried a banner of golden lilies on a blue field, the whole surrounded by a red border blazoned with white dots. The horsemen were in armour, though none wore a helmet, and they were followed by armoured men-at-arms who came on foot. One of the newly arrived riders wore a surcoat that showed three hawks on a green field, and Hook realised the horseman must be an Englishman who had been in Sir Roger's service, and it was that man who spurred his horse to the church and, leaning from the saddle, pounded a shortened lance against the door. He shouted something, though Hook was too far away to hear, but it must have been words of reassurance because a moment later the church door opened and Sergeant Smithson peered out. The two men talked. Then Smithson went back into the church, and there was a long pause. Hook watched, wondering what was happening. Then the church door swung open again, and the English archers filed warily into the sunlight. It seemed that Sir Roger had kept his word, and Hook, watching from the ravaged gable, wondered if there was any chance of joining the bowmen, who now gathered in front of the Englishman's horse. Sir Roger must have agreed that the archers would be spared, for the French appeared to be welcoming them. Smithson's men piled their bows, arrow bags, and swords by the church door, and then one by one knelt to a horseman, whose stallion was gaudy with the golden lilies on their blue cloth. The rider wore a gold coronet and bright polished armour, and he raised a hand in what appeared to be a kindly benediction. Only John Wilkinson hung back close to the church. "If I can reach the street," Hook thought, "then I can run to join my countrymen." "No," St. Crispinian whispered in Hook's head, startling him. The girl was clutching him. "No," Hook whispered aloud. "No," St. Crispinian said again very firmly. The girl asked Hook something and he hushed her. "Wasn't talking to you, lass," he whispered. The blue and gold horseman held his mailed fist high for a few heartbeats, then abruptly dropped his hand, and the massacre began. The dismounted men-at-arms drew swords and attacked the kneeling archers. The first of the bowmen died swiftly because they were unprepared, but others had time to draw their short knives and fight back. But the Frenchmen were in plate armour and they carried the longer blades, and they came at the archers from every side. Sir Roger's man-at-arms watched. John Wilkinson snatched up a sword from the pile by the church door, but a man-at-arms ran him through with a shortened lance. And a second Frenchman cut down through his neck so that Wilkinson's blood sprayed high on the door's stone archway, which was carved with angels and fishes. Some archers were taken alive, bludgeoned back to the ground and guarded there by the grinning men-at-arms. The man in the golden coronet turned and rode away, followed by his standard-bearer, his squire, his page and his mounted followers. The Englishman, wearing the badge of the three hawks, rode with them, turning his back on the surviving archers, who called out for mercy, but there was no mercy. The French had long memories of defeat, and they hated the men who drew the long war bow. At Crecy, the French had outnumbered the English and had trapped them, and the French had charged across the low valley to rid the world of the impudent invaders, and it had been the archers who had defeated them by filling the sky with goose-fledged death, and so cut down noble knights with their long-nosed arrows. Then at Poitiers, the archers had ripped apart the chivalry of France, and at that day's end the King of France was a prisoner, and all those insults still rankled, and so there was no mercy. Hook and the girl listened. There were 30 or 40 archers still alive, and the French first chopped 2 fingers from each man's right hand so they could never again draw a bow. A big-bellied, wide-grinned Frenchman took the fingers with a mallet and chisel, and some of the archers took the agony in silence, while others had to be dragged, protesting, to the barrel on which their hands were spread. Hook thought the revenge would end there, but it had only begun. The French wanted more than fingers, they wanted pain and death. A tall man, mounted on a high horse, watched the archers' deaths. The man had long black hair that fell below his armoured shoulders, and Hook, who had the eyesight of a hawk, could clearly see the man's handsome, sun-darkened face. He had a sword blade of a nose, a wide mouth, and a long jaw shadowed by stubble. Over his armour he wore a bright surcoat that showed a golden sun from which rays snaked and shot, and on the bright sun was an eagle's head. The girl did not see the man. She had her face buried in Hook's arms. She could hear the screams, but she would not watch. She whimpered whenever a man screamed under the exquisite pain that the French exacted as revenge. Hook watched. He reckoned the tall man who wore the eagle and the sun could have stopped the torture and murder, but the man did nothing. He sat in his saddle and watched impassively as the French stripped the surviving archers naked, then took their eyes with the points of long knives. The men-at-arms taunted the newly blinded archers and scoured out their sockets with sharp blades. One Frenchman pretended to eat an eyeball, and the others laughed. The long-haired man did not laugh. He just observed, and his face showed nothing as the blinded men were laid flat on the cobbles to be castrated. Their screams filled the city that was already filled with screaming. It was only when the last blind Englishman had been gelded that the handsome man on the handsome war horse left the square and the archers were left to bleed to death, sightless under a summer sky. Death took a long time, and Hook shivered even though the air was warm. St. Crispinian was silent. A naked woman, her breasts cut off and her body red with blood, collapsed amidst the dying archers and wept there until a Frenchman, tired of her tears, casually stove in her skull with a battle axe. Dogs sniffed the dying. The sack of the city continued all day. The cathedral and the parish churches and the nunnery and the priories were all plundered. Women and children were raped and raped again, and their menfolk were murdered. And God turned his face away from Soissons. The Sieur de Bournonville was executed, and he was fortunate because he died without being tortured first. The castle, supposedly a refuge, had fallen without a fight as the French, permitted into the town by the treachery of Sir Roger, found its gate open and its portcullis raised. The Burgundians died, and only Sir Roger's men, complicit in their dead leader's betrayal, had been allowed to live as the city was put to the sword. The citizens had resented their Burgundian garrison and had never abandoned their loyalty to the King of France, but now, in a welter of blood, rape and theft, the French rewarded that loyalty with massacre.
Je suis Melisande,
the girl said over and over, and Hook did not understand at first, but at last realized she was saying her name.
Melisande, he asked. Oui,
she said.
Nicholas. Nicholas,
she repeated.
Just Nick, he said. Just Nick.
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 They spoke in whispers. They waited, they listened to the sound of a city screaming, and they smelt the ale and the blood.
I don't know how we get out of this place, Hook said to Melisande, who did not understand.
She nodded anyway, then fell asleep under the straw with her head on his shoulder, and Hook closed his eyes and prayed to Crispinian. Help us out of the city, he begged the saint, and help me get home. Except, he thought with sudden despair, an outlaw has no home.
End of Disc 2.